Hey, it's Adam. Welcome to our weekly teaching podcast here at South Hills Church in Corona, California. Our hope is that as you listen in, you'll find yourself laughing and learning and being challenged and encouraged to grab hold of who God has made you to be. Enjoy the message. And if you're taking notes today, the title of my message is Slip and Slides, Suckers and Cynics. Slip and Slides, Suckers and Cynics. For those of you that it's your first time, welcome. When I was a kid, we had this ritual on Saturday morning. This is a time before the internet and before like anything was on demand. So you had to wait for the good cartoons on Saturday. Anybody remember this? And that was the day where my parents, who were very strict about what we were allowed to eat during the week, let us have unlimited sugar cereal. It was glorious. And we were smart too, because we were allowed to have one bowl, but the size of the bowl was never dictated. And so we would dig and we would find the biggest mixing bowl we could find and pour like a whole box of cereal in there and just eat out of it. And I don't know if anybody else did that for just the fat kids in the Smith family, but we loved it. It was how we lived. And we watched these cartoons and we knew exactly which was coming on. And the thing of it was, you didn't want to leave once the block started, because you wanted to hit all the cartoons and the commercials. The commercials were key, because all the commercials were about toys and things you wanted. And it was the only time I ever saw advertising, really. Things have changed a little bit, right? And so everything that I saw, I wanted, and there were certain things I wanted more than others. And the thing I felt like I couldn't live without, and I don't know if you remember this, but it was something called the Crocodile Mile. Anybody remember this thing right here? It was basically a slip and slide. This commercial was on all the time, and basically the idea was that you would run down the slip and slide, and it seemed like it was literally a mile long, hence the name, the Crocodile Mile. And you would fly down this thing, and then there was like a bump and a little pool. You'd hit the bump and go through the crocodile's mouth and land in the little kiddie pool, and I was like, this is going to make all my summer dreams come true. And I asked my parents, and they were like, no! We're not getting it. We're poor. And so I was like, man. But then I found out a couple weeks later that some kids down the street had gotten one. And we never really liked them, but we decided we were wrong about that. And we went down there and we're like, we heard you guys got a crocodile. We got to confirm first, right? We heard you guys got a crocodile mile. They're like, we did. And we're like, we feel like we've misjudged you. And we would like to be friends. And so they were like just setting it up. We were so excited. We went out into the backyard where they had it set up, and we're like, we're gonna do this thing. And they were like, you should go first. And I was like, I can't believe I'm gonna be the one to break it in. I was so excited. And here's the thing I didn't realize at the time. Anytime you're a kid and you're asked to do something first, you're the guinea pig. They don't trust the situation, and they're like, this guy's dumb, he'll do it. And then we'll find out what we shouldn't do. And the thing that we discovered early on was that like the crocodile mouth doesn't work by itself, okay? You gotta hose that thing down constantly to make it work. Basically, they just like hosed it once, shut off the hose, because their dad was all strict about water. And by the time I actually went to run down it, the heat had just sucked all that water out. And it was just hot, dry vinyl. And we didn't know that this was not gonna end well, right? And so I'm like, let's do this. And I go running down and I dive onto this crocodile mile, and it's just like, just ripping the skin off my stomach. And all my friends were there, and so I didn't wanna look like a wimp. So I was just, they're like, you okay? And I was like, I feel good. I get up and they're like, you're bleeding from your stomach. We didn't even know that could happen. And I'm like, we need water. And so they were like, well, let's not do what he did. And so while I was, you know, just covering my entire chest with Band-Aids, these kids started hosing that thing down. One kid got smart, went in the inside. He's like, we need to lube this thing up. And he gets some, like, Dawn dish soap, and he's just slumbering all over the place. And the next kid is like, we're going to do it. Here we go. And so that kid winds up, he runs as fast as he can, dives on the thing. He has a different experience. He goes flying. I mean, just like, whoosh, right? He goes right through hits the bump. The thing that we didn't understand was, you might not like the commercial just land in the kiddie pool. If you get enough dish soap, you will go way beyond. which means you got to pull that thing back from any privacy fences that exist in that backyard. So the next kid goes and he's like, poof, 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 hits this wall. And we're like, ooh. And I was like, glad I went first. Man, that kid really paid for it. And then we're like, you know what? The third time's the charm. We're going to get it. We're going to nail it this time. And the third kid gets up and they're so excited. You know, we redirected it away from the fence, right? Which was smart. This kid runs down and goes and like hits the bump and gets scared. And so puts his arms out and knocks out the entire crocodile little overhang thing. And because his arm is caught and he's going so fast, he just rips the whole pool thing off of it. And it's just completely torn to shreds. And at that point, we were like, ooh. And I was like, I gotta go, you know? And we just left. Three uses, and it was garbage. Like, this thing that I had been admiring and lusting after for years on Saturday morning cartoons just was torn to bits. And also, before it got trashed, it was a death trap, you guys. And this was, I think, the first time that I had an experience where I was like, wait a minute, not all advertising is true. This wasn't what the commercials explained. Like, companies don't always keep their promises. Not everything pictured is included. There was a real crocodile in the cartoons. They didn't have that in the box. Right? Like, I would guess that you probably had moments like this too, where you got excited about something and then you got into it and you realized that, man, it's not what you thought it was going to be. That not everything or everyone can be trusted. And I think the older you get, the more you see how prevalent this idea is. And you learn in life to be cautious, right? Because you have to be. And I think this is sort of the state that we're in right now, because we live in a world where we're always being sold, right? Everyone around you has an agenda. They have an angle. They have a side hustle, probably three. And I think for a lot of us, it turns us into very skeptical people, suspicious of everything. Although that's not all that we are, because there's another part of us that still wants to believe, right? That still holds on to hope, which is why even as we grow older and wiser, we can still get tricked as adults. Remember Fat Free? they were just telling it, they're advertising, you just eat these snacks, they're fat free. You can be so skinny. And I ate so many of those snacks and I was like, I'm gaining weight. What is happening? And they were just like, don't worry, we'll replace all that fat with carbs and sugar. And then later on, we were like, wait, those things make you fat, right? What about the housing market bubble of 2007, right? Where we were all like, I can buy a house. And they're like, absolutely. And you're like, I should. I deserve it, you know? I should be able to buy a $600,000 house with a part-time job from Wendy's. That's how things, you know what? And some people are like, is this too good to be true? And you're like, no, I'm sure that the banks can be trusted. I'm sure everything will be fine. And they couldn't, and it wasn't. And some of us lost big. And when we realize in these moments that we've been had, we think like, man, I should have known better. How could I fall for that? We feel stupid. We feel like a sucker. And we hate that feeling. We'll do almost anything to avoid it. But at the same time, we also love movies about con artists. Don't pretend like you don't. You're watching a movie about someone who is doing something that you know is wrong, and you're like, I hope they get away with it. I hope they're able to trick everybody, right? Oh, man, rob that bank, right? You remember that movie, Catch Me If You Can? I loved it. Leonardo DiCaprio, and he's playing this guy, and he sneaks around, and you know, he's doing all this stuff. He's flying commercial airlines without a license. He's running an ER. He is arguing cases in court. And the whole time we're like, I hope he gets away with it. Now, let's flip this around. Imagine that you were on trial for something very serious and you had a lawyer who was only pretending to be a lawyer. Some of you are like, I feel like I have lived through that case, actually. Not cool, right? That's not what we want, because this is sort of the way that we work. We love the idea of outsmarting other people, but we hate this idea of being outsmarted. And we end up adopting mantras like, you know, don't get your hopes up. If it feels too good to be true, it probably is. If he shenanigans once, he'll shenanigan again. That was either a proverb or something I saw on TikTok. I can't remember. And there's some wisdom to all these things, right? But when they make us feel like we have to always keep our eyes peeled and we always have to keep our head on a swivel, we start to believe that the only person that I can trust is me. We become suspicious of everyone. And I think, like, is there anyone that feels more suspicious than a spiritual leader? Probably not. I mean, all of us have seen too much not to be pretty skeptical, because so many say one thing and do another, right? We have all lived long enough to see enough so-called spiritual leaders take advantage of people and shame them and manipulate and steal money from and sleep with their followers. And we're like, no thanks. And the saddest part about this is it's not new. Religious con artists have existed ever since religion. It's been around forever. Even in the time of Jesus, there were lots of pagan cults, temples, and superstitions, and there were even plenty of failed Jewish messiahs. People that claimed to be God's chosen one to lead the people into victory and make everything right, and then it didn't work out. They were frauds, and they died and went away like everybody else. And I think for some of us, it's easy to think like, man, if I would have lived in the first century and I could walk and talk with Jesus, man, it would be so much easier for me to believe. But I don't know if that's true. We think that because we know the rest of the story. But the people that are living through these moments in Scripture, they don't even know they're in a story. They're just living their everyday lives. They have no idea what is coming. And I think it might be easier or have been easier to believe in Jesus after he had resurrected, but I think it would have been a lot harder to believe in him as you watched him die, which all the original followers of Jesus did. And there were two people who had a closer view than anybody else. And it wasn't his mother, it wasn't his brothers, it wasn't his disciples, it was two strangers. It says this in Luke chapter 23, verse 32, that two criminals were led out to be executed with Jesus, one on his right and one on his left. And maybe you imagine Jesus being crucified alone, that it was this big moment, but that's not how it worked, because the Romans never crucified anyone alone. Crucifixions were common. And in fact, if you read through Roman history, which I'm sure a lot of you are going to do this afternoon just for funsies, you would discover factoids like this. In 4 BC, the Romans crucified 2,000 Jewish rebels at once in a place called Sepphoris, which later became a makeup franchise. At least the first part of that's true. In 70 AD, the Romans crucified so many people at once that historians say they ran out of trees. I mean, it's astounding. This tells us that crucifixions were a common occurrence. Every man, woman, and child who grew up under the Roman Empire had seen quite a few. It was brutal. And the Romans' final insult to Jesus wasn't that they killed him, it was that they killed him in this particular way, as if to say to him, "You are not special. This is what we think of you. You're not a king, you're a nobody." And that's why they crucified him between two common criminals, because they were nobodies too. They were such nobodies that we know virtually nothing about them. We don't know their names, we don't know their stories. Who they are is essentially reduced to bad people who did bad things and now deserve to die. It makes me wonder, like, what did they do and why did they do it? Did they take unfair advantage of other people who were disadvantaged, or were they just sort of trying to do whatever they had to do to survive? Where were their family and their friends at the cross? Like, did anyone love them enough to show up for them on the worst day of their entire lives? We don't know the answers to any of these things. I imagine this mix of hurt and hatred rolling around in their hearts as they looked out at this crowd who got some sort of sick pleasure out of watching them suffer. And then the man who's being crucified between them musters all of his strength to raise himself up and fill his collapsed lungs with air so that he could say one thing to the crowd of people. And you know that the criminals are thinking, what's it going to be? I know what I would say. And this is what Jesus says. Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And I bet the two criminals thought, not what I thought you were going to say. I was going to say something. It had a lot of bad words in it. It had a lot more anger in it. But Jesus is different. And in fact, this is stunning to the two criminals on the cross. They had never seen anything like this before. An innocent man being tortured, forgiving those torturing him as they're torturing him. And you would think this is so unusual and astounding that everyone would stop and notice simultaneously, that the crowd would stare in silence at this unbelievably otherworldly response, but that's not the case. It says in verse 34 that the soldiers gambled for his clothes, that the crowd watched and leaders scoffed. He saved others. Let him save himself if he's really God's Messiah. The soldiers mocked. If you're the king of the Jews, save yourself. And the reason they shout these things is because they believe that Jesus is just another fake. One more in a long line of failed messiahs. Men who make empty promises that there's no way they could keep. Leaders who take advantage of hurting people who desperately are looking for something, anything, to place their hope in. And this may shock you, but I think their ridicule is reasonable. When you listen to the complaint, I get it. It's logical. How are you going to save us if you can't even save yourself? Good point. One of the criminals echoes the crowd. He says, so you're the Messiah, are you? Prove it by saving yourself and us too while you're at it. Now, there's a word for this. For all this angst, for all this hard-heartedness, there's a word for this thing that the criminal and the crowd are experiencing, and it's called cynicism. And cynicism is essentially the belief that you can't trust anyone because everyone is driven by self-interest and always has ulterior motives. It's the assumption that when push comes to shove, everybody's really just going to do what's best for them and never the people around them. It's this pervasive pessimism that's always anxiously awaiting to be let down. It's a hardened hopelessness that believes that what wins in the end is humanity's most selfish impulses and worst instincts. And yet, as bad and as dark as cynicism sounds, I truly believe that every cynic has a right to be cynical. That it happened for a reason. If you're cynical, you're cynical because you were lied to. At some point, you were misled or taken advantage of. You were wounded or hurt or betrayed. And that protective part of your psyche rose up within you and said, never again. Never again. But I gotta tell you, just because you have a right to something doesn't make it good for you. I think oftentimes we find ourselves being cynical because we feel like it's safer than the alternative. And what is the alternative to cynicism? Vulnerably facing our fears and fragility, admitting that we aren't invincible, that others have the ability to hurt us, that we can be taken advantage of, that we don't always know what we're doing, even when we're giving it our best shot, that everything that we don't like and think is unfair isn't everybody else's fault. And that no matter how hard we try, we don't have the ability to fix what is broken about us. I mean, we can't admit that. That's crazy. And so we insulate ourselves from being hurt further by walling ourselves off and hurting alone in isolation. All the while projecting that, you know, I'm fine. You know, I'm strong. I'm good. We got this. But we don't. And this criminal, I think, mocks Jesus because he can't believe that anyone could have the power or the ability to save themselves and choose instead to suffer for everyone else. Jesus does not make sense to cynics because cynics try to save themselves by outsmarting and outmaneuvering everyone around them. But Jesus, he saved everyone everywhere by loving and laying down his life for all who hurt him. And when a cynic looks on Jesus, they can't understand the motivation because it's not self-driven. It's driven by love. And the criminal on the other side of Jesus sees this and he confronts the cynical criminal two crosses down. He says, "Don't you fear God even when you've been sentenced to die? We deserve to die for our crimes, but this man hasn't done anything wrong." This criminal, he softens just long enough to notice what nobody else seems to, that there is something very different about Jesus. That the worst things imaginable have happened to him, but it hasn't shaken his compassion for or love of humanity. And this is, by the way, the reason that Christians have never believed that bad things don't happen to good people. We believe the worst thing happened to the best person, who endured it, overcame it, and grew something beautiful from it for the sake of everyone else. Maybe this criminal who defends Jesus had heard some of the stories about Jesus healing the blind or feeding the 5,000 or casting out demons or raising Lazarus from the dead, but I don't think he needed to. What he saw Jesus do from the cross that day was enough. Because I think there's no greater miracle than loving your enemies and praying for those who persecute you and forgiving those who betray you, even as they continue to inflict pain on you. Some of you are like, that would be a miracle. I would rather try and raise myself from the dead than have to do that. That's not even a miracle I want to be a part of. And yet this is why Jesus is so astounding in this moment. This moment is what convinces this criminal that Jesus is more than a man. Because this is not something you can do in human strength. And he speaks up and he pleads with Jesus. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And what we don't hear that the original audience would have is the similarity between what this man is pleading with Jesus and an Old Testament prayer prayed by King David. David says this in Psalm chapter 25, verse 7. "Do not remember the rebellious sins of my youth. Remember me in light of your unfailing love, for you are merciful." You know what mercy is? Mercy is when someone has the right to come down hard on you, but instead, they do not give you what you deserve. They give you something better. And David is admitting to God, "I am messed up. I'm broken. I've done some bad things. And some of those bad things I did because bad things were done to me. I hurt other people out of my hurt, often unintentionally. But don't, when you think about me, don't remember that. Remember that I am more than just that." It's as if this criminal on the cross is saying to Jesus, "Jesus, I believe that you are the King, the Christ, the Messiah, and I have sinned, but I'm more than my sins. The world wants to tell me that all I am are my worst moments, but I know that you are loving and you are merciful. Remember me for who I really am, the person you created me to be, the person I truly am on the inside before the world jaded me." He's saying to Jesus, like, don't give up on me yet. A man who is taking his last few breaths, who doesn't really have the opportunity to make amends for his wrong, he's like, Jesus, don't give up on me yet. Jesus replies to him, I assure you today, you will be with me in paradise. I think we tend to think of paradise as a place, and it may be partially, but it's more than that. I think paradise isn't as much a place we go to as a person who came to us. To believe that Jesus is with and for you, no matter what you're going through or where you're at in life, is to experience paradise. And you've seen this. You've seen people who are in the worst possible situation, and yet they have peace and joy. And you realize something otherworldly is going on in them. And after Jesus says this to the man, all three men on the cross die. But 3 days later, the man in the middle comes back to life. This is the ultimate twist of all twists. I don't know how much you guys have done research on this. Not a lot of people come back to life after they die. It's a very rare occurrence. And people realize that Jesus isn't a fake, that he could be trusted, that their hope wasn't wasted on him, and they begin to believe that in Jesus, anything is possible for anyone, including tax collectors and prostitutes and criminals on a cross. One New Testament author later wrote this in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8, that God saved you by his grace when you believed. And you can't take credit for this. It's a gift from God. Salvation is not a reward for the good things we've done. So none of us can brag about it. And then he says this, for we are God's masterpiece. I know that maybe for some of you, there is this fear inside of you. Maybe it's part of the fear that keeps you away from church in general. Most Sundays, you have this fear that when God looks at you, that all he sees is disappointment and anger over the worst things that you've done that you wish you could take back, but you can't. But the New Testament tells us that when God looks at you, what he sees is a masterpiece. He sees his creation. He sees what he made and loves and was willing to die for, even though when he died for you, you may never turn back to him. It was still worth it. What this criminal asked for, God graciously gives to all of us. He remembers you, not for your wrongdoing or your worst moments, but for the person that he made you to be and loves unconditionally. And this is why we keep telling and retelling the Easter story. Every year my kids are like, what are you going to preach on Easter? And I'm like, I mean, it's the same story. It's the, you know, we're not really allowed to add many twists, you know. Maybe this year he doesn't come back. I don't know. I'm just, is that, no, that's wrong, that's bad. We keep telling it not because it's new, but because it's powerful and true. And we believe that the power of the resurrection isn't just that God brought Jesus back to life, but that God can bring anything back to life, including what cynicism killed in you, your dreams, your future, your relationships, your sense of safety and security, your ability to experience joy or believe that anything good could be waiting for you up ahead. And the more we open ourselves up to this, the more cynicism loses its hold on our hearts, and we can let go of all of our hiding and striving. We can surrender to the only one who is truly trustworthy, and that's what salvation feels like. You see, the difference between these two thieves dying on the cross with Jesus is not the horrible things that they did or the horrible things that were done to them. It was their responses to those things. And that's what sets any of us apart. These two thieves are not just a picture of two people. It's a picture of two paths that all of us have the opportunity to choose to take. Because the truth is, life is hard. And we're all imperfect. Maybe you don't want to hear this, but suffering is inevitable. It will happen, and skepticism is understandable, but we get to choose whether we embrace cynicism or experience salvation through surrender. These two men on the cross got that choice, and you have the same one. And I think for some of you, the reason why you ended up here today was to be positioned at this crossroads, to look in the mirror of your own life and realize that you have the same decision to make. And up to this point, everything that happened to you and everything you did that you don't like to survive what happened to you has made you so cynical. And it has kept you from a lot of pain. It's also insulated you from love. Because we can't just close off a particular portion of our feelings. If we kill the dark ones, the painful ones, we kill the other ones as well. And some of us have closed off our lives to the potential of actually believing that life could be good. This is the promise of the resurrection. Not just that if you pray a prayer, you can sneak into heaven when you die. It's the belief that when you surrender your life to Jesus and stop trying to do it all on your own, when you decide that you are going to connect with and commune with God instead of being cynical about everything and everyone around you, your heart opens up and you begin to see possibilities you didn't even know existed before. You begin to experience love and connection you didn't believe were available to you. Scripture calls it salvation. The thief on the cross calls it paradise. We might call it heaven. It's this thing that we invite into our hearts that lives within us, and then we live within it when we die. Maybe you're here today to let go of all of the striving and trying to hang on. Maybe today is your day of surrender. Would you do me a favor and just close your eyes, bow your heads in this moment? There's nothing magical about it. It just helps you focus. And I want you to think about your life. The reason God brings us into this place is so that we have the opportunity to think about where we are and where we've been and where we're going. And some of us avoid moments like this because we don't want to know where we're going. Because we don't like the state of our existence. Maybe some of you are in here today and you were brave enough to admit, my life is not working. Man, if you knew what happened to me, you would agree I have the right to be cynical. But I'm also miserable. Only Jesus can fix that disconnect within you. Only Jesus can be trusted in the way that you need to trust to be saved. Do not let the fact that other people proved not to be trustworthy to convince you that God is just like them, because he isn't. Jesus is wholly unique. And that he loves you unconditionally. And that he can be trusted no matter what. And that he wants to lead you into life to the full. And if you're in a place today where you're like, man, I need that. I want you to do something brave. I want you to just slip your hand up. I want to pray for you in these final few moments of our service. I'm not going to call you out or embarrass you. I just want to see who I'm praying for. If you're at this place where you're like, I need to surrender my life to something bigger than me that loves me and has the power to heal me. I see your hands, and more importantly, God does. I'm going to say a prayer over all of us today. But if you raised a hand, or maybe your heart is too broken to do that, but you know you should have, I want you to pray along in your heart just a simple prayer of like, God, I need you to come into my life and to take over, to heal me and forgive me and make me well again. And those of you that are sitting around, others who may have raised a hand, would you just pray in your heart that God would be present with them and powerful to them, that today would be the day that changes everything. Let's pray. God, we just admit that we need you. God, we are broken people who have been hurt and who have done our fair share of hurting. God, we have done destructive and self-destructive things to survive this world. In a way, we are all criminals. God, we have a reason, a justification to be cynical, because our heart has been broken again and again and again. Our trust has been let down and shattered again and again and again. But today is a different day. Today is a day not of cynicism, but of surrender, of opening our hearts and throwing up our hands and just saying, like, God, I can't continue doing this over and over again. I can't keep putting my trust in myself because I let me down. I can't keep putting my trust in other people and thinking they're gonna save me, or a political party or some sort of organization that's gonna rescue me. God, I need you. I need my Creator, who when he looks at me, does not see all of the bad that I have done. He sees a masterpiece, a creature that he created, that he loves unconditionally, that he wants to rescue and forgive and bring to a place of freedom. God, you died so that we could have life, not just in eternity, but in the here and now. And God, I pray that as we crack the door of our heart to you, that you would enter in, that you would fill us with your Spirit, that you would give us the paradise-like peace that only you can bring, that we would have a sense that you are near, that you are here, that you are with us, that you are for us, that your love is big enough to resurrect the most dead and broken parts of us. And today we would celebrate as the day of our salvation, the end of our cynicism, and the beginning of our eternal surrender. In Jesus' name we pray, and everybody said, amen.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's message. We hope you heard something that spoke directly to where you're at right now in life. To find out more about our church, hit up our website, southhills.org/corona, or follow us on social media at South Hills Corona. And if our messages have made a difference in your life, help us get the word out by rating and reviewing this podcast. And as always, you can support the ongoing work of our church by giving through our website at southhills.org/give and selecting the Corona campus. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next week. God bless.